AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 69 for August 26, 2010. Que sera, Sarah. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Well, man, is it great to be back in the studio. I've been out traveling, and we had after hours on the road last week, but I love being back in the studio with the auto extremist, Peter DeLorenzo, here as always.
Good evening, all my munchkins.
And David Welch is back with us, too, today.
Great to be back. I missed being here for the last few weeks.
Yeah. No, it's good to have you back. And in a little while, we're going to have Joe Serra on, a dealer principal who we'll be talking to all about the business and what's going out there in the market these days. But we got to start off with some very tragic news that just broke. We just learned today, in fact, just within the last hour or so, that Jack Pitney, the head of marketing for BMW North America, was tragically killed in an accident on his farm. That's all the details we have right now. But Jack made his mark on this industry in the time that he had. A lot of people may not be aware, but Jack is the guy who, and there we've got him up on the screen right now, was the guy who launched the Mini brand in the American market and did a bang-up job with it. I mean, he really put it on the map in a very short period of time. And I think the success that he had at Mini was what landed him the job as VP of marketing for BMW North America.
Yeah, he hooked up with Crispin Glover, Bogoski, the ad agency, and was just one of those points in time where it all worked.
All the planets were in alignment.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did a terrific job marketing Mini and sort of made it, I mean, I'm a Mini owner, kind of made it a cult brand for the, you know, for the Mini owners. It's, you know, they have this thing in the, which I thought was brilliant, in the owner's manual that says you should give a thumbs up to every Mini owner, and every Mini owner waves at each other. It's
no kidding.
And you don't see with any other car, and you know, Jeep and some other brands do have this, you know, they have those Jeep Jamborees and things. Other brands do have kind of a kinship, but nothing like Mini does, and I think he was a big part of that, and a really good guy, and he was also only 47, which is, you know, really terrible. I just can't believe it at that age.
And Peter, he launched the Mini brand without doing any television advertising. That's got to be unusual in this business.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I mean, when the agency, he didn't have a big budget. It was sort of the precursor of the social media type of launch where you stay away from television. There was no need to do it, and it was all creating buzz and word of mouth, and you know, they did some great stuff, and it worked tremendously well.
Yeah, it's a case study in sort of guerrilla marketing and grassroots marketing, because it wasn't a big national advertising kind of thing.
And they came up with a great theme line, Let's Motor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, even though he's a relatively young guy at only 47 years old, he did make his mark in this industry. You know, everybody is going to remember Jack Pitney and what he did here. Speaking of marketing people, we saw another change at General Motors of them stealing yet another executive away from Hyundai, or Hyundai. I got to keep training myself to say it that way.
I'm not buying that.
What?
But the whole pronunciation thing.
Well, you know, like I've talked about before, it was the Koreans 25 years ago who taught me to pronounce it Hyundai. And now the American marketing guys for the company are all over my case whenever I say
it
that
way. Because they blatantly said, well, we're, you know, back when, we're going to be Hyundai, because it's kind of like Honda. You know, so save us from that, please, whatever the explanation is, because we know what the explanation is, really.
Look, if you're going to steal executives from any car company, marketing executives, I mean, why not Hyundai? I mean, you're talking in the past 10 years, it's gone from being the basement bargain brand, the cheap car that, you know, that mostly used car buyers went for, to a legit competitor to Honda and Toyota and really everybody else, but really going after Honda and Toyota. And they're getting better pricing on their cars. It's not just a discount brand anymore. They pioneered, didn't they do the 100,000-mile warranty
yep.
first that Ford and GM, I know GM copied it. I don't know if Ford did or not.
10-year 100,000-mile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did the money-back guarantee if you
assurance.
The assurance program, which was copied by others. It would amaze me about Hyundai is that they have tremendous turnover in the executive ranks of the North American business unit. And here it is, this upstart Korean company, but they seem to have their finger on the pulse of what would get people into their showrooms better than any other company, the Japanese, the Germans, or the Americans.
But that was Joel Lewanek who
yeah.
did all that.
This is,
now he's a GM.
These are two key blows for whatever it is.
Right.
John Krafcik's a genius and all that, but losing Joel Lewanek and now Joel goes and gets his right-hand man.
Who I understand they went to school together. These guys go back.
Chris
way,
Perry.
Yeah, and all through their careers they've worked together.
And Hyundai put up, and I heard directly, a huge fight to keep him. But this, make no mistake, this is a huge blow. And, you know, having been in the whole ad game for a long time, it's not uncommon for anyone who gets one of these jobs, they need their people with them.
Especially those two, because what I hear is Joel's the guy with the great ideas, wants to go off, and Chris Perry's the guy that pulls him back over the edge of the cliff every now and then.
But when you go to these companies and you're tasked with the marketing thing, the long knives come out early, and people want to, throw grenades and blow your stuff up, and you need people you can absolutely trust that you've been to war with. And so it's perfectly logical that Joel would make a move like that.
Well, and you look at GM, not only is it logical that Joel would bring in his people, but you can say this about all the domestic car companies for the past 10 years, and even well before then, they had cash needs for the pensions and healthcare bills we were talking about earlier or before the show started, and they had jobs banks that wouldn't let them lay people off. So their marketing departments were really sales groups, keep the factories humming. They were discount shops, coming up with new spiffs to get people in. Hyundai did some of that too, obviously. Some of these programs are those kinds of incentives, but they were more creative than just $5,000 on the hood or 0% financing. And that's what a lot of the people at GM did. Even if you have people with marketing talent there, what they've been doing for the past decade is discounting and moving volume. It's not the same as brand building and marketing.
I totally agree.
He needs people that know how to do that and that he's comfortable working with, obviously.
No, I keep saying that people don't understand how transformational the last year has been here in Detroit. It's a whole new ballgame now. Where, to your point, you don't just build cars and blow them out the door just to support this legacy cost mountain.
Yeah, and we'll get our guests to talk about this, but the domestic car companies were shoving cars off in the dealers and saying, sell it. Well, what if the buyers don't want it? Well, you sell them.
Figure it out.
Yeah, figure it out. If it gets really bad, we might throw another $1,000 on the hood. And, that push system. And now, if they can make money in this kind of market, that tells you that the production capacity is low enough where they don't have to just blow volume out for the sake of blowing it out and foist off unwanted cars on their dealers.
And the dealers are already starting to complain that they don't have enough cars.
They are, and they're keeping the automakers are keeping a very tight lid on production.
And they should keep a tight lid.
Sure, because look at the bottom lines. They're, in the case of Ford, solidly profitable, GM doing decent profits. Chrysler's at least at a break even or an operating profit.
The key is that average transaction price, and it has gone up. And Ford is average transaction for Ford.
Will Joel Lewanek and Chris Perry be able to turn the sales situation around at GM? And what they really have got to go after is retail sales.
Well, still the biggest problem facing General Motors, it's an image problem. And everything they do has something to do with image.
Oh, that's right.
And they have to, because PR isn't going to do it. It's going to come from all of Joel's marketing moves on behalf of those four brands.
I don't think GM is worse off in terms of fleet than big competitors. I recall we pulled these numbers when they filed the IPO prospectus that someone was making a big deal about GM being 33% fleet in the first half of the year, but I think Ford was 32.
Yeah, Ford's not far behind, but I think
it's a reflection of the market more than GM not being able to sell a retail. I'm not trying to defend GM necessarily. I'm saying that I think this market is very weak still. I mean, it's better than where it was, so there's a little bit of a sigh of relief that it bottomed out and things are better than it was last year and that people can make money this well. Still not a great market.
Well, a senior industry executive this week shared fleet and retail sales numbers with me, which I had never seen before, and I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked at how high the fleet sales are at the Detroit 3. What this guy is claiming is that Chevrolet brand alone is roughly 85% fleet. And I was knocked out by these numbers.
How much?
85%.
In the first 6 months?
Fleet.
For which?
Yes, for Chevrolet.
The whole brand?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
First six months of this year?
Well,
so they said in their S-1 that I think they were 32% fleet.
So this would be through July.
Okay, first.
I'd have to go back and look at the numbers, but if they were 32% fleet for the whole company for the first 6 months and Chevy 70% of their sales, there's no way.
Well, I know they showed that on the pass car side, 42.5% was fleet for the whole company in the U.S. market. But I'd like to get the source of these numbers to share them with me.
85. I mean, if someone told me Chrysler was 85% fleet, I'd be stunned that it was that much. Mm-hmm. And Chrysler's been heavier in fleet than most for a lot, you know, for a lot of the year, I think.
Yeah.
We have to get to the bottom of it.
I agree totally, but I was shocked by these numbers. Hey, speaking of Hyundai and what was going on, I got a chance to drive the new Hyundai Equus this week, and I can't talk about the driving impressions because that's under embargo, I think, until September 7th. But something interesting that they're doing, they're going to sell this car in very low volume to begin with, and you don't have to go to the dealership at all. We'll have to get our guest, Joe Serra, to comment on this, too. But the whole idea is sending a salesperson out to your home, you know, with all the literature, bring a car, you can do a test drive, you don't have to go to the dealership, and you can even buy it in your home or your office.
But it's still done through a franchise.
Through a franchise dealer. In fact, in some states, it's illegal to do this in your home or your office. You do have to go to the dealership. But
oh, really?
In a lot of states, you don't have to do it. And so this is very interesting where they're going to be able to do something that Mercedes, BMW, Lexus are not going to be able to compete on simply because they sell so many cars. This would be a logistical nightmare. Same thing goes for your maintenance or any service or anything like that. You call them up. They send somebody out to pick up your car, drop you off another Equus or a Genesis sedan, and they take your car and bring it back when the service or repairs or whatever it is are done. And I just thought, very interesting. And the other thing that's fascinating, when I talk low volume, I mean, they're talking like a couple of thousand vehicles in the first year, 2,000-3,000. And so they're not doing this to sell all kinds of cars. They're not doing this to gain market share. They're not doing this to increase profitability. They're really doing it just to change the whole impression of what the Hyundai brand is all about. And their target is 7 Series BMW, S-Class Mercedes, LS Lexus.
Well, they have to do something dramatically different. They really do they have to zig where the others are zagging. And, you know, I think it's smart. You know, they just...
Yeah, they've got some momentum. The Genesis did a nice job of moving things upscale. I think the Sonata has...
I think Genesis has sold very well, though.
No, but it's a different kind of car on the road for them.
It is. But, you know, at the end of the
day... This
is a whole other discussion, but, you know, it's great to see them moving things upscale. Great for them. But if you can't sell the cars, who cares? Although one other number that Hyundai showed us was shoppers. How many people shopped the Sonata so far? Or these were July numbers. it blows everything out of the water. There were more people shopping Sonatas than F-Series pickups. F-Series is the best-selling vehicle on the market. So I asked him if it's being shopped by more than any other vehicle that's out there, how come it's not the best-selling car in America? And they claim we just can't build these things fast enough.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I totally buy that, but I think clear they could sell more if they had.
I need my platinum-tipped shovel, I think, for that.
Speaking of platinum-tipped shovel, you don't like the Volkswagen Phaeton, do you?
I think it's the wrong car from the wrong company at the wrong time. Other than that, I think it's a great car. But, you know, I think to bring it back to this market is sheer folly. It's just...
Yeah, what has changed since they swung and missed on that before for the brand?
I got to mention, Peter's rant this week on his website was all about the Volkswagen Phaeton, and now I'm being criticized for pronouncing it Phaeton. It's Phaeton.
Yeah. Whatever with that. But we all remember when Phaeton meant a whole different kind of vehicle.
Oh, yeah. If you go back to the 30s. Early days of the cars, the 20s and 30s.
So, you know.
As in dual cowl Phaeton.
Yeah. It's just, it's not unexpected because, you know, there's a level of arrogance from Ferdinand Piëch down, you know, and he sets that tone for the company. And if he wants to do it, they're going to do it, no matter, you know, if you walk in there with reams.
Well, what makes them think they can do it? This thing was overpriced and didn't sell at all when they launched it the first time.
You know, they perennially don't understand the U.S. market. I mean, that's the only thing I can say.
And the weird thing is, okay, the Phaeton was, I remember test driving one that was priced at, I think, $78,000. It's a very expensive car, way above anything VW sold, right? Well, their strategy with the rest of their line now is to move down price to compete with Camrys and Accords and Malibus and Fusions with $21,000 midsize cars and cheaper compacts. So most of what they're going to sell, they're moving more to the mainstream market, lower prices, and then they're going to put this thing out.
Not to mention, they've spent billions of dollars solidifying Audi's reputation around the world.
I don't know that VW and Audi brands have that much interaction, though, do they?
Well, that's the company line. However, in the marketplace, every time Volkswagen does a new car, it's bumping against the bottom of the Audi thing. The Phaeton was, like, right there with the A8. And, you know, I don't get that. That's like, why do you do that?
Well, the other thing is they left such a huge gap from a top-of-the-line Passat, which I believe is probably their top passenger car right now, right, price-wise, to go from...
CC?
I think the CC, okay, maybe it's the CC.
More expensive.
Is it more expensive than a
sure,
Passat?
Yeah.
Okay, either way.
It's a great product, by the way.
Which is a cool car, yeah. Right. Yeah. But you know, you can't go from what it's a CC max out-wise, price-wise, $35,000 maybe, something like that?
A little more than that.
A little more? Yeah. Okay. But then to go to from $40,000 to $75,000, it's like that's just too big a step.
Yeah, and let's not forget that Volkswagen's also their perennial quality issues, mm-hmm. and a dealer body that's just under siege all the time with, you know, quality issues. And, you know, you've got a very complicated machine in that Phaeton. I mean, the shares underpinnings in some degree with the Bentley Continental. And
it's still going to have the W8?
The W12.
Or the W12.
Yeah, W12. I guess because a buddy of mine has one, and he said the new one's out in Germany, and there's really no difference. They're just,
so
you know.
Just taking the same car and bringing it back?
Man. Just... You know, but they've been doing that to their U.S. dealers forever. It's just like, we know. no, you don't. But it's just like every year it's the same thing.
What do you guys make of the story that came out of Europe this week, Volkswagen saying it's interested in purchasing the Alfa Romeo brand should it become available?
I think it's just Piëch just messing with Sergio. Just because he can. I don't know.
That is bizarre. I guess it doesn't really cross over with Audi or any of other VW's other luxury brands.
It's just...
Don't they share a lot of production with Fiat and Alfa? I mean,
I don't know.
I don't know either. It's
and Sergio said that the Fiat dealers, the insiders, will sell Alphas.
The U.S. Fiat dealers.
Yeah, the U.S. Fiat dealers. So maybe it's just sort of trying to disrupt their whole.
But I think you got a good point there. I think it is Piak just messing with Sergio's head. As if Sergio doesn't have enough on his plate. Now he's got to have the German saying, we'll buy this brand. But I don't ever see it happening. No, I think the Italians would rather put concrete galoshes on it and dump it in the lake than sell it to the Germans.
Yeah.
Although Lamborghini is owned by the Germans, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, that was
owned by the Volkswagen Group.
Or Fiat Group.
Oh, they still, okay.
Volkswagen Group.
Is it owned by the group or is that owned by the Agnellis?
You know, I can't say. I don't know the structure.
Yeah, I lost the narrative on that.
It's hard to keep track of everything that's out there. We try to do as good a job as we can. But hey, this is a good time to bring on our guest for the show today, Joe Serra. Joe, come on up and sit here with us. So for the audience who don't know who you are, give us the thumbnail sketch background.
Well, I'm on the retail automotive side, own automobile dealerships, and based here in Michigan, but I have franchises in six different states, and I look at it by location. I have 24 locations and represent 45 brands, different brands.
45 brands?
Yeah,
how do you keep track of it all?
Well, that's why I was sitting here listening and trying to learn from you experts. But from a domestic standpoint, I'm strictly domestically GM. And then, so I don't have the Ford or the Chrysler on a domestic side. But then when it gets out to the, you know, Japanese, Asian, Germans, I have most of those brands. So a mixture of it all. So it does keep you busy.
Was there a strategy to saying just having GM and not the domestic brands that you do have?
It became a strategy. And the strategy today is in order to grow and learn, you have to build relationships. And I had, over the years, had built a pretty good relationship with the General Motors personnel. I had some Ford stores in Chrysler. But if you don't have enough of them, it's just, you just, so over time, when things, I say, you know what, I know these people, they know me. And that's how opportunities arise, you know. And so I just decided I'm going to stay on that ship. And then I also knew I needed to not just have domestic. I needed to have a breadth of the other brands. And so that sort of was a strategy, whether it was right, wrong, or indifferent. I can tell you a year ago, or it didn't look too good.
I'll bet it didn't, because you had a number of Saturn stores. In fact, the audience should know you were an executive at Saturn.
Yeah, Saturn, exactly.
Now, your
right.
family has been in the car business forever,
father,
right?
That's how I got in the business. My father started in the business. His is a great story. What a great mentor. But, you know, he was born and raised in Italy, came over on the boat. I'm one of 10 children, last business I ever
We're in Italy.
You know, I knew you were going to ask that. And I've never been to Italy myself, but I know it's a lower part of the boot, but I couldn't even tell you, and I apologize. I should know that.
It's big Italian
Pianti
families.
Grande or something. I don't know.
My grandfather was the oldest of 10 kids. So.
Really? And I'm the fifth of 10, and when I graduated from, I went to Albion College, that I did not want to get in the business. And here
not
I am today.
Not in the retail business.
Well, I didn't want to get in the automotive.
The car business
the
at
car
all?
Business, you know. And
what happened?
You know what happened? Fortunately, I was driving down the road with him, and it was my senior year, and he asked what I planned on doing, and I was an accounting and a computer major, and I was explaining what I was going to do, and he listened, and he said, you know, that's great. What about, you know, my company? At the time, he just had the one store, and I said, you know, I've seen a lot of children of this industry in the auto industry, sons and daughters of dealers, and, you know, they haven't been as successful as I like, and we all have reputations and pride, and I wanted to make my own mark. And I said, you know, I just would rather try to do something on my own and versus getting into business and always being Al Serra's son, because he was great at what he did. I mean, he was phenomenal. And he listened. He said, well, first of all, you're always going to be my son. And second of all, you know, I'd love to have you in the business. I could use some help, and, you know, I think you could do well in it. And when he said you could use some help, and I'm so glad we had that talk, because this business is a riot from my end. You know, I don't know if it is from the manufacturing end, but it's just a fun business, as you know, great people.
So you went into your dad's dealership?
Yeah, I did. I went in, and what he was doing.
What was the transition where you left the dealership and went to work for General Motors?
Yeah, that was many years. I joined the company in 82, and then in 90. 1996, 1997, so 15 years. So I'd been running stores, been a partner, was a dealer for years, was a Saturn retailer. As you know, Saturn, GM had acquired all these Saturn stores, and I think at the time it was 40-some that they had didn't want public ownership to have. And so their mission was to figure out what to do with it, how to get it away from GM. And the mission was to take these, the same brand of Saturn stores, take them public, because that was a time when stores were going public. And they reached out to see if I'd had an interest in doing that. And quite frankly, it did interest me. I'd been an auto dealer for, you know, 15, 16 years. Had a great store up in Grand Blanc, and my other stores had great people running them. You know, I think we'd like the next challenge. And to be able to possibly take something, take it public, not with my money, somebody else's company, one brand, a brand that had neat processes and procedures that I think I could have. So that was why I did it. And but unfortunately, I told GM at the time, I said, the only reason I would come back, because I was a minority partner in the company, and my father had a bunch of shareholders and a bunch of other partners. It's because at the time it had grown. At that time, I think it was 16 or so stores. I said, if he ever puts this for sale, and I was in a position where I could buy it, I might come back for that. And after 2 years, that's what happened.
So it must broke your heart to see Saturn get axed.
Yeah, and it was a tough go, and the part of it just recently getting axed, it was sad only because I can tell you those were the retailers and that they had, their retailer body was outstanding, some of the greatest group of dealers I've ever seen. I thought personally the brand made some sense. I have no idea if it made money for GM. Don't.
We can tell you the answer.
Yeah.
No.
But that being said, ran different. I don't know how they make. I don't know how they do their accounting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got a lot of things.
Some years it lost a lot of money. But
yeah. Not knowing how they do things, but I can tell you it was a tremendous customer base. You mentioned earlier about loyalty, the mini brand, you mentioned that. I can tell you, my Saturn customer base and their loyalty to the brand, their loyalty to the retail outlets,
is probably the best in
great,
the business.
As great as any as I've seen.
Well, look, all the customer satisfaction surveys showed it. You know, it was typically Lexus and Mercedes, mm-hmm. 1 and 2, and then Saturn, which for a mass market, much
right.
lower priced brand was astonishing.
Yeah.
No one in that segment came close to it.
Yeah.
Did better than Mitsubishi?
No, I don't, as a matter of fact.
And so, you know, the good thing is I learned a lot from that. I learned a lot from what they did, and I've tried to take some of those things and incorporate throughout our organization. So we, even though it is no longer there, it's a brand that's been dismantled, we did gain from it as a company. My company, we gained from it for sure.
What's your sense now of General Motors, now that it's brushed out, broomed out all these brands, including Saturn? Mm-hmm. What's left? You know, we were talking about all the marketing issues and how they're bringing in new people. What's your sense of how GM's going now?
Well, I think, you know, obviously, whatever they do, I'm 100% on board because I've got a great investment with them.
How many GM stores do you have?
Yeah, I was going to mention, of my 45 brands, I would say 60-some percent are GM brands. So it has
heavily invested.
It. Oh, I'm all in. I mean,
and then some,
and still in. I mean, I'm still looking. I'm just going to be building a new facility for them, so I'm still going. And I can tell you, I don't know a lot of the leadership anymore, but I have the ones I have recently met of the new leadership. I'm very, very impressed.
Who have you met?
And I've had an opportunity to meet the president, Mark Royce.
Well, we're all big fans of
yeah.
Royce here.
And, you know, if you'd asked me 4 months ago, 5 months ago who he was, you know, I knew his father.
Mm-hmm.
I knew his father. I'd never met him. I shouldn't say. I think I may be at an auto show one time I was introduced, but didn't know him. And in a short period of time, I'm more than impressed.
Yeah, now, he's one of the guys in this business right now.
I just am very impressed. And he works hard. I'm just impressed, and that's great because you got to. That being said, I then Chris Liddell, the CFO, I've had an opportunity to meet him, and had him. He took the time on a Saturday to come out to the store to learn some things, that's impressive. So very few of the leadership, but I like the team, and you know I'll tell you, I'm whatever they need, we're going to go to work for them, go hard. But are they out of the woods? Absolutely not. You know, we were talking earlier about them doing an IPO and doing it so soon. And you know, I question that if I was sitting there. It doesn't make sense to me. I don't know what the rush is.
Well, I know a lot they'd of us rather think that they're under enormous pressure from the White House to do their IPO.
And that's not the
in
right
time for the November election.
And if that is the case, then that's really, really a mistake. You don't ever make, you know, if that is the reason, that's a mistake.
You can't underestimate it. I still think that there's a lot of pressure on them to get rid of this government motors tag and just get the government out of management of the company so that you don't have to worry about pressure on other issues down the line. I think management really wants out of it. Plus, Ed Whitaker was not a fan of government being in there. Dan Akerson is a Republican. I don't think he's going to want the government being in there. Someone else reported he was a Republican. I doubt he's a fan of government ownership. So management itself probably has some personal philosophical reasons on why they want them out. Doesn't mean, you know, that they're going to make dumb decisions about it, but there's clearly pressure for a number of reasons to get the government out of General Motors.
And I can respect it, and I think as a dealer we would love that as well, because we hear, you know, you're owned by the government, but I don't want to make a mistake. You know, the way I look at it, you have one chance. And you have one chance to do this thing and have the IPO and be successful and pay back as much as you can to all the shareholders, which are us, right? I'd rather they do it right versus wrong. And that'd just be my only concern.
Well, but this is very interesting to get your concern, because you're a retailer. And do you get the sense that if GM was able to get this government motors monkey off its back, it would help sales?
Oh, it can't hurt. I can tell you that right now. It can only help.
There are people in the company who do think that, and I think they're right, because there are certain buyers that just hate this whole thing.
Oh, I hear it every day. Not every day. I hear it enough. And so it can't hurt. But I can tell you, if they go out and they don't perform and don't give back, now you're...
Could hurt just as much.
Oh, yeah, be careful what you ask for sometimes. And it's just, for me, it's earlier than I anticipated. If I was sitting in that GM boardroom or I was sitting in Washington, wherever it might be, I would have, you know, we run our companies. You got to run them with a long-term vision, a long-term plan, a long-term strategy. And I don't want forces to make me make a quick decision that maybe isn't well thought out. That's all.
Well, they're on a real tightrope walk here, because for all the reasons we've mentioned, whether it's getting the government out or being pressured by the government or getting rid of this government motors tag, they're under heavy pressure to do it. At the same time, and the government knows this, the people in the Treasury Department know that if they try to sell too much stock too soon, they get a lousy price, they aren't going to pay the taxpayers back, and they're going to take a beating for that at some point in the public. You know, and it's the same kind of beating. You know, whether it's the government still owns it, we don't like you, or it's the government no longer owns it, but we didn't get all of our money back, we don't like you. It's still an image problem. It's still going to hurt sales and the brands. But speaking of the brands, you know, these four brands that remain they've got some repair work to do in terms of public image. You sell them all every day. Talk about where you think Chevy, Buick, GMC, and Cadillac are in terms of the comeback trail.
Well, they're all in the right. They're all progressing the right way in regards to. And I'll just do them quickly. If you look at the recent introductions of any of the brands and the models they've had, they've had great success with all of them. This is probably, you know, since '82 when I got in the industry, so it's been a few years now. It's very seldom you'll have a successful launch. Matter of fact, they were known for non-successful launches, and they've been hitting it on all cylinders pretty much with every one of their launches, so you have to commend them for that. And as we all know, as good as the dealers might be or as good as the manufacturer might be, it comes down to product. I mean, when it's all said and done, good product makes bad dealers look good, and bad product make good dealers look bad. So we need product. I'm only as good as that. So they're all making strides. Is there more work to be done? Absolutely. And I know that, so Chevrolet is making some great strides with their current ones, but that's a big portfolio. They've got an awful lot of models, big portfolio.
Sure, you got a hot Camaro, and then you have an ancient Impala that sells to a lot of fleet.
Then you
got
the Malibu, which is obviously doing well. You got the Equinox. You have some good stuff, but you got big. It's just a big
portfolio. The Cruze is coming out, but the Cobalt's been on the market for a while, and that doesn't do you guys any favors.
And it's hard when you get that. That's just a lot of. It's coming from a family of 10 children versus I have two. You know, it was hard for my dad. He had to do an awful lot to feed 10, and I have to do less to feed 2. And it's just tough. Cadillac's doing some right things. This new SRX that they've came out with is a wonderful product. They're making great strides. They're working on getting their image back there.
But which other luxury brands do you have besides Cadillac?
Mercedes, BMW, Porsche would be what I would say would be the luxury brands.
So do you have Audi or Lexus?
I don't. No.
But Mercedes.
I'd love to have
BMW.
Both of them, but just don't, if anybody wants to know.
I agree that Cadillac's made progress. The SRX is red hot, but the problem I think they have is you walk into a Cadillac showroom, you got a CTS, which is a really good car. You got SRX, which is hitting it out of the park. The other stuff's somewhere between irrelevant and old.
Yeah,
and then you go to Mercedes or BMW dealer, and you got a dozen different models.
So they need to come. You're exactly right. I'm not disagreeing. The Escalade does well still, but you're right. After that, we're playing with fewer cards than the other brands. So Buick's an interesting one in that. I think their whole portfolio will be brand new within a two-year period. I mean, everything. It'll be the newest
of
all.
What do you think Regal's going to do?
So far, it's doing well, but it's just so early. I mean, we're just now having them hit our lots, and the customer reactions have been great. But Buick, and we can't kid ourselves, it's still a perception of a Buick, and perception is reality. And so you were earlier talking about the marketing team, which I've not met. I've heard great things about. They will be the most important people in my life for the next 3 years. And if they can take that Buick image that we have.
Big cars for old guys in Boca Raton.
Absolutely, and bring in and allow somebody who's 35 to say, I'm going to go look at a Regal. Somebody who's 45 wants to look at a LaCrosse 40. If they can accomplish that. Because once the customers get in and experience it, the Buick lineup, in my opinion, rides as well as any of the GM brands that they have. It's a tremendous ride. So, but you got to get in. First, you got to come to the store. You got to get in. Or we can go to them, which we do a lot of. I heard you mention that.
Yeah.
The other thing about Buick is not just an old person's brand, but people say as big as a Buick. I mean, it's known for big, huge cars. How do you market something like a Regal and sell it at on the showroom level? How do you get the people into it? It's a smallish midsize car compared to a LaCrosse. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to have the Verano or whatever they're going to end up calling it, the smaller Buick beneath that.
That's why the marketing thing is absolutely the most critical thing for GM going forward. They've got the products coming, but boy, if they can't change the perception, they're dead.
It was just a couple years ago when Dave Kiley, who used to write for Business Week with me, joked on the Don Imus show that Buicks had one feature. They had a left turn signal that never shuts off. And that's the kind of image that they're going to have to counter.
Joe, what's your sense out there right now? We read a lot of dealers complaining they just can't get enough cars from GM, that they could all sell more if they could only get more. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a true statement. I love it. You know how many too much is? One too many is too much. And right now, so you never know. And I can tell you from experience of having to stock product and having it sitting there and trying to figure out, having stuff,
Didn't that cost you guys a lot of money?
Presented to me or sold to me or jammed to me, however you want to say it, by the manufacturers. That's not a good way to live. I mean,
you guys
the
had
flooring.
To pay interest on that.
Oh, my flooring costs. My inventory levels as a group. Amongst the stores, I went from $250 million that would sit there, down to about
$250 million in inventory.
Sitting
there.
Depreciating every second.
Yeah, you can
paying porters.
You can
to
drink
wash
a lot of beer to try to solve that. You can hear it depreciate.
Paying porters down to wash them and
down to about 80.
Done on
and
a lot
and
of
things
metal.
Get damaged and things sit. So down to about 80 some. You can see this huge difference. 83, I think, as I drove today. So the key is, which maybe it shouldn't be 83, maybe it should be 100, but it doesn't need to be 250. And
are you short on cars right now, by the way?
Yeah, we are short.
It's better to be short.
You can't have, again, pick what devil you want to play with. I'm going to play with short all day long because it has.
Brings the transaction prices.
Well, it helps everything. It makes it, it allows you as a retailer to work with the consumer, and there's just, you don't have to distress. You can sell it with pride. There's only so many of them. It helps the value of the used vehicle markets. Those values have risen as well. And transaction prices have gone up. Costs have come down because we're not spending the money on interest and all that. So it does work. Now, are we missing some sales coming up? Absolutely. I'm sure there is. But like I said, what is that number? And
is that true of all the brands that you have? Are you short
really,
on product
it
everywhere,
really
up
it
and
really
down
is.
The line? Huh?
You know, we're in, and because all manufacturers are trying to figure out where this market's going. And I think they might miss it again. I don't think the market, personally, I don't think it's as strong as people might think it is.
I don't think anyone thinks it's strong now.
Well, but they did a few months ago.
Well, they did a few
and
months
I kept
ago.
Saying,
in fact, at the beginning of the year, they were saying 12.5 million SAR, and now everyone's backed off their 40.
When this year started, somebody was asking me, I said, you know, I'm not smart, so I'm going to say 2010 will be 10, 2011 will be 11, 2012 will be 12. And I really think that'll be the growth. And then it'll slow. Again, we're in no rush on this deal. The market, it's going to take some time. And we've got a lot left out there. There's some issues still out there. But the neat thing is, in this difficult time, manufacturers are making money. The dealers are getting healthier. We're getting our feet back. There are still some issues. You know, we still have lenders, financial lenders, not for with the consumers, but with us as dealers, still nervous about loaning us money for, you know, growth and facilities because they're just curious. They don't know where the manufacturers, if they're still going to be there. So that's still an issue, but it's a lot better than it was 12 months ago, I can tell you that.
Well, no question. When you had GM and Chrysler in bankruptcy, that's a disaster. Mm-hmm. What's your feel for this month, August sales? We saw a nose down, a drop-off in July. And mm-hmm.
And I think August will come in softer than July.
Ooh, I don't like hearing that.
I think you'll see that.
This is supposed to be a pretty good month because you're usually clearing out the model year for the new stuff coming in, right?
But remember, there wasn't that many to clear out. So
okay. There
are cleared out, but you don't have a lot of them to clear out. Uh-huh. Where a year ago, you had a bunch to clear out, and you needed cash for clunkers. You had some other things out there. But I still think it's going to be, and this is just my opinion. I don't have all the data, but I bet you it would come in under what July was.
Ouch.
Here's something I'm interested in, because you're saying you're tight on inventory and you probably lost some sales. Is that because, like in the old days when you had $250 million worth of inventory, you had, you know, a Noah's Ark of cars and options out there. You had two of every possible option available. So whatever somebody wanted, colors, options was always there. So you just don't have the selection?
There'll be a particular, you know, as a consumer, it's a major investment.
And you want what you want.
They do want what they want. Now, they'll give a little bit here and there, but they do want that. And if you don't have it, you run the risk of them find it somewhere else.
So Americans are still unwilling to custom order and wait a couple months to get it.
They'll do it, but we know what the incentives are today. We don't know what tomorrow brings, but there are some. And those buyers that will be willing and are willing to order, they're more at the higher level than the entry level buyers.
Good. Well, I think this is a good time to turn to questions from the audience. It's time to get to rapid fire. Ben, let's bring up that graphic. Okay, Joseph N. wants to know, if Peter is opposed to the Phaeton based on it competing with Audis, then cannot the same complaint be made about the new larger Taurus competing with Lincolns?
Well, in that case, they're going to push Lincolns up further. So I don't expect, right now it's a little shaky, but I think going forward, Lincoln, you're going to see some really changed Lincolns coming.
I think so. You know, it's interesting, Ford saying that, I think there's a big internal debate going on right now. How far do they take the Lincoln brand? Can they really go up against Mercedes, Lexus, BMW and the like? And what investment would that take? And if you're going to do that, shouldn't you take it globally at that point? I think this is a big discussion going on inside the company.
I think they're a long way from taking on the German.
But they are. Brands. But this is where you start laying the groundwork to say, okay, if we're going to get there, then we got to start laying some billions into the product development pipeline to make it happen. And if you're not going to do that, you got to make that decision now, I think. Rumblestrip wants to know, Peter, well, you think bringing back the Phaeton is a mistake. What is the best stealth luxury car in the market?
Stealth luxury car?
Yeah.
Is it maybe a sleeper? Is that what he's talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Probably a black Panamera. I have a confession for all my auto extremist guys out there. Yeah, they know my history of criticizing Porsche for veering off their mission. I drove a Panamera, and the thing was just fantastic. And I'd have to have blinders on, so I only look at it from the B-pillar forward. But once you're in the car and you go down the road, the thing is just absolutely, it just blew my mind that Porsche engineers, they really know what they're doing.
Volt 240 wants to know, is the next generation Malibu just a refresh or a major redesign?
It's a major. We've seen.
Yeah, it's
major new redesign.
Yeah,
major
and I think it's a new platform, too, or at least it's, if it's not new, it's heavily overhauled.
Question for Joe Serra. How frustrating was it seeing no new products coming from GM for years until it was too late to save the brand, even though you guys had such a great reputation for service? And I think this is referring to Saturn.
Yeah, it was frustrating. And that's where I do feel sad for all the employees of the Saturn brand, those in the retail facilities, those that work for Saturn, because it was frustrating because they were doing the right things. They listened to customers. They were thinking outside the box. But, you know, as I said earlier on the show, it comes down to product. And product will speak, and product will make us look better than we are or worse than we are. In this case, it made us look worse than we were.
Yeah. Product is what people buy.
It's what it is.
Hey, we got to get to some of the phone calls that come in here. Ben, let's get to the first phone call that we've got.
Hi, John. This is Oscar Rutherford from South Carolina. And I just wanted to talk about the Mazda thing with Lewis Booth that was on Iowa in Detroit last weekend or the weekend before, I forget. Anyway, Ford and Mazda today announced a $350 investment together in their auto lines factory in Thailand, so it doesn't appear that they're splitting up there. And regarding the actual divorce, I guess you'd call it, when I looked at who actually bought the majority share now, it's a bank. Now, a bank doesn't sound like exactly wants to run a car company, so that led me to believe that Ford will buy back later with interest tacked on, just a conspiracy theory, I guess. But in China, it actually makes sense for Mazda to split off Ford, because if Ford bought them back, that would give them three joint ventures total and a partially owned subsidiary total. And in China, of course, you have to have a joint venture to expand, so having more would allow you to spread your investment out, so it actually makes sense. Anyway, that's it. Bye.
Yeah, no, I think you raise a good point. I called the Ford-Mazda relationship a slow-motion divorce because I see them splitting more and more apart. But you make a really good point. Ford and Mazda announced today a $350 million joint investment in building a new plant in Thailand to make the new Ranger pickup truck, and I think they're making the Mazda 2 and the Fiesta there as well. Good point. They're not completely divorcing, and as Lewis Booth said on the program, where it makes sense to go together, they're still going to go together, but I still see them going more and more their separate ways, and when you hear this mantra of one Ford, one Ford, one Ford, they don't want to do joint ventures anymore. They want to pour all their money into the Ford brand and hopefully into the Lincoln brand as well.
But they are, from an engineering standpoint, they're still tied up with Mazda in a number of ways, so you can't just completely walk away from them. Also, right. He asked a quick question about the banks. Mm-hmm. It's not unusual for Japanese banks to own chunks of the car companies.
That's a great point.
Nissan was owned, you know, before Renault came in, big chunk by the banks, and Isuzu was too when GM had bought a piece of it. I'm sure there's some other relationship.
Oh, yeah. In fact, if you go back historically, the banks were aligned with the big...
the Keiretsus.
Keiretsu groups. And what is it? Is it Mitsui is typically with... I shouldn't even get into which banks are aligned with which car companies because I can't keep it all straight. But David makes a great point. It's not unusual for banks to own a chunk of equity in the automakers. Let's see here. George from Brooklyn wants to know, what does Peter think of The Expendables?
I haven't seen it. I like the promos. I mean, it's mindless, idiotic fun, I'm sure.
Pedro Fernandez wants to know, will Ford or GM ever be able to catch up to the Sonata, or are they destined to play second and third banana to this class leader?
I'm not ready to just hand the world over to the Sonata. I think it's very good, but I think there are plenty of competitors either here or coming for the Sonata. So got to be careful with canonizing the Sonata too quickly.
I'd agree with that. You know, whatever is the newest car in its segment, it should be the best car.
Yeah.
It better be the best car because, to your point, right on the heels are the competitors nipping at them.
There's an interesting point in this discussion, though, and that is the next Camry and Accord better be damn good if they want to compete with that car because the current Accord, to me, kind of fell flat, and the Camry didn't really hit it out of the park either. They've got... Toyota and Honda have to step up.
Well, to John's point, though, I mean, with all the technology accelerating the way it is, whatever you come out with, it better be good. It better be the next big thing, or you're going to be behind
instantly.
You will.
I mean, look at the big step forward Ford made with the Fusion. All that was a refresh of the product. They did some nice little styling changes, front and rear fascias. They fixed every single problem in the car through sync and everything into it.
Sometimes you just need to execute better what you have.
Right, but what I'm saying is you watch it. When the next Fusion comes, it's not just going to be a nice refresh. It's going to be killer, and you can believe they've benchmarked everything on the Sonata.
I'm more of a believer with Ford now. I mean, I thought it was more image and the whole GM and Chrysler had this stain of dishonor on them, and there was a lot of that. And Ford had, I thought, competent product, but not great. But all the new stuff coming out.
Starting to come together.
Yeah, it really is. And I think the styling is subjective, and I've hated it for a long time. I'm starting to like that better, too. I still think GM has a better design house in terms of what they're putting out, but Ford's stuff is, I'm more and more impressed with every
car they launch. Ford stuff out of Europe. I'm not totally sold on Ford styling out of North America yet.
I'm not either, but it's getting better from my perspective anyways.
Yeah. Hey, let's take another phone call in here, Ben.
Hey, guys, it's Jonathan Brown out in Old Japan, New
Jersey.
David, it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
Listen, I'm just curious. Do you think the Equus and the Genesis main purpose is to elevate the Hyundai image so they can sell a lot of Hyundai Sonatas? Is Volkswagen doing something similar, trying to elevate the image of VW and sell a lot of $20,000, $30,000 vehicles? That's my question. Anyway, like I said, it's good to have you guys back. Have a good evening.
Yeah. No, that's why you do it with cars like that. The difference is the Equus will surprise people that it's from Hyundai and get people to look, whereas the Phaeton has been done before. It didn't impress many people, if anyone. It was a failure, and now they're coming back with it. It's, you know, you threw your curveball before and it didn't fool anybody. And so you're going to throw that same pitch again. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, and let's not also forget that the Korean mindset to be considered right with Mercedes and Lexus and BMW is very strong. And they've been wanting to make this move a lot sooner. And they broomed a bunch of American executives because they were saying, you know, guys, you're really not ready. So this is a real obsession for them.
Well, and there's mother necessity at work here, too. Korean labor rates are going up. They don't have the huge cost advantage that they used to, and that's eroding about every other year when they do a labor negotiation over there. So they have to move up market and get better pricing because they're not going to have the big cost advantage forever.
Well, remember, Hyundai wanted to launch a luxury brand a couple of years ago. And to your point, Peter, the Americans went, whoa, 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 let's get Hyundai nailed down before we launch yet another brand. And, you know, when you look at the model that's been successful over the last decade or decade and a half, it's a mass market brand and a luxury brand. So you got Toyota, Lexus, you know, Nissan Infiniti, Honda Acura. And Hyundai's looked right at that and said, hey, we need a luxury brand. So this is the first toe in the water of bringing out a luxury car. And I agree with you, David. They're doing something new and different. You know, we talked about having the salespeople go out to your home and all that sort of thing and all your maintenance. They'll come and get the car for you. Another thing, too, is just making an iPad available in the car. That's where your owner's manual comes. I've had people tell me, oh, you're kidding. It comes with an iPad? I want to buy the car just because it comes with an iPad.
That is brilliant.
So it's changing people's perceptions already. So good question, Jonathan. And Ben, let's bring in another call here.
Yeah, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. I'd like to hear from your guest that General Motors has a slew of new products coming out, but I just kind of wanted to get his thoughts on, you know, any concerns about any of these new products kind of overlapping one another and kind of a fear of General Motors going back to the old brand engineering thing, such as the new Cadillac Lambda that's coming, whether or not it's really going to interfere with the Buick Enclave, you know, and they also mentioned earlier, you know, the new Buick Verano, whatever it's going to be called, and competing with the Chevy Cruze. That is General Motors, by having so many products, are they just going to be causing troubles for themselves like they did in the old days? Thanks.
Yeah, it's a good question.
It is a good question, and, you know, I'm sure the same push and pull that the manufacturer were getting from the dealers, you know, unfortunately, every brand has a dealer network that needs to survive. And so, you know, you mentioned earlier, Cadillac just had the two units, the SRX, CTS. You can maybe say they have to have a portfolio that allows it to be supportive. And that's where they get into, if you're going to, do you build something specifically for Chevrolet, specifically for Cadillac, or is there a way to combine but make them unique enough? And it's a fine line to go down and a scary line, but I can see where his concern might be. And we as dealers do have it. You know, I mean, I would just take the SRX, the Equinox, and the, which one am I missing?
The GMC one.
Yeah, Terrain.
Terrain.
You know, there's three right there that you could say, you know, you could argue.
What about right within a Buick GMC show? How much interaction do you see between Enclave and Acadia buyers?
Yeah.
I mean, do people sort of shop both? Yeah. They are kind of different vehicles, yeah, though, but, in many ways.
So I know where the caller's coming from, and it's obviously an issue, but they're trying to keep their manufacturing costs down and provide us as dealers with enough product that we can make a profitable return on our investment.
Well, you know, again, I think GM's getting better and better at it. You know, again, wiping out a number of other brands helps, and not having these legacy costs where you have to do everything on the cheap so you can't differentiate it as much.
Right.
But I think it's a great point. There still is overlap there. Here's a pretty good question. Does anyone have comments about Bill Ford saying Lincolns may be sold in foreign markets? I don't think their products are anywhere close to being ready to compete.
Well, they know that. We've been over that, yes. But you have to have a vision down the road. And, yeah, maybe down the road, if they go where they want to go, they might be able to do that. Are they there now? No, not even remotely close.
Well, the other thing, I talked to a Ford executive a few months back about this, and you look at a market like India. You got to be there because it's going to grow. But you're selling $4,000 cars. Tough to make money on that, even with labor rates and the fact that there are cheaper cars over there. You want to make money in the market, you got to sell luxury to the people who do have money over there. And it's a great time to get in selling luxury in some of those markets because there's a lot of growth and you can establish your brand before there's any baggage.
Sure. India, 1.2 billion people. And so their market is probably where China's was 10 years ago, is probably the analogy I'd draw.
But you want to make a lot of money in India? Build roads.
Yeah. Well, but this is what we were saying about China 10 years ago, too. So
yeah, they keep building roads to nowhere.
And having 60-mile-long traffic jams where people are spending the night in the traffic jam. And it's just getting going, folks. Hey, we got another phone call here. Let's bring that one in.
Hi, this is Jim from Sioux Falls. I have a question for Mr. Serra. How does he feel about the foo-farah that went on when General Motors tried to reduce the number of dealers? Seems to me they were just trying to do what Honda and Toyota and some of the other big manufacturers do. There's not a dealership for sometimes 100 or more miles, but just trying to thin out the dealers just created this huge backlash. So just wondering what your opinion is on that. Thanks.
My opinion is obviously, and you made a statement earlier, the number of General Motors dealers versus some of the other brands was obviously heavier and larger. Unfortunately, to have a manufacturer do it versus a marketplace eliminate dealers just gives me great pain. Those dealers, the market's got to decide that, and the market would decide that over time. And I know this was an opportunity for them to try to clean up an over-dealer situation, but to use a bankruptcy to maybe do that was just not the right way. And
did you lose any stores other than the brands that were shut down?
No, I didn't, fortunately, but I did lose four Hummer brands, two Saturn stores, two Pontiac stores, potentially a Saab, but Saab stayed.
How do you do with the Saab and Hummer stores?
Well, you get creative. We So I had my pain, 9 brands that I just had pain in the two Saturn stores. You know, unfortunately, you have employees and exactly what those GM dealers
and
that got wound down.
No compensation for this.
No, it was really sad. So the market needs to dictate it. Going to your question on the Hummer facilities, I put Cadillac into one. Mm-hmm. So I went out and bought a Cadillac franchise, put it into one enough to figure out how to change the look. You know, those Hummer buildings are hard to change. The other one out in Colorado I made into a Volkswagen franchise, and it turned out great. It really worked well. It's beautiful. One of the franchises I mentioned earlier out in California, we ended up departing California. I sold the property, so that went with it. And the fourth point, which is out in New Jersey, fortunately, I didn't have a Hummer building. We had yet to build, so I didn't have to deal with it.
That must have been a massive financial hit. Yes, it was. Okay, you don't have to answer that.
everybody felt pain. You know, I mean, the dealers felt pain, the manufacturers felt pain, the public felt pain, the employees felt pain. There was pain through this whole thing. Nobody escaped it. The workers, the unions, I mean, we can go on and on. There was pain with everybody, suppliers.
But that's all behind you now.
You know what? That's that. It is what it was. Now we got to go forward, and the cards are on the table. Let's play.
Well, we're at the top of the hour here. This is probably a good place to wrap up this conversation. But, Joe Serra, thanks so much for coming in. Really interesting to get your viewpoint on everything. It's excellent to hear the people who are in the trenches, as I call it, the retailers. That's the front line in this business.
Well, Joey, are you going to stick with Saab? Are you going to stick with the new ownership?
Well, that's going to be decided once they present to me what their new dealer agreement is going to be. And based upon that, then you'll be able to make a clear decision. What are their needs going to be versus what do I gain from it?
Got a new 9.5 coming?
Well, it's just not the sales, too. In the Saab case, I happen to be out in New Jersey, and there's very few Saab retailers, and the service business is pretty strong, pretty good, pretty solid. So you got to look at that. But, it's become pretty simple math. If they say we need a standalone facility and we can sell, we'll look at what we can sell, and either works or it doesn't work. And my thought is it's currently in with a Cadillac franchise, which happens to be the largest Cadillac store in the nation. So
really?
I'm in sure. Jersey. Yeah. It's a great store. And it'll be a standalone. So my gut says down the road, I'll probably have to slide it out, put it in its own facility, which, you know, whether that pencils for me, which I think it could, or I decide to depart. But my gut says we can make it work. I do like the product, and it works well out there, and the service business, as I said, is solid.
Well, we had a new 9.5 at our Dream Cruise show last week, and it is, in my opinion, the best new Saab I've seen in at least 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Everyone says that. How does it stack up against other kind of mid-sized luxury cars?
I haven't driven it yet, so all I can tell you is,
go on sale?
They're shipping them in as we speak.
Shipping them right now? I thought they said July, so.
Yeah, I know they're coming off the boat. I don't know if they're actually retailing them yet. That I don't know. But as I was winding down the show, David, great having you back here, man.
Good to be here. I'll be gone for the next few weeks, but
okay.
I'm headed overseas, man.
Where?
I'm going to China.
Oh, you're kidding.
This is the China trip, yeah.
Oh, but this is not for business, right?
No.
You're adopting a daughter.
That's right.
Congratulations to you and your wife.
I'll be gone for a couple of weeks, yeah.
Wow.
It's going to be a wild trip.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
That's great.
And Peter DeLorenzo, the extremist here himself. Thanks for being here, man. It's
always a pleasure, John.
Then we've got to remind folks, you can always friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/Autoline Detroit. Follow us at twitter.com/Autoline. You can always read Peter's rants and raves and other insights and analyses at autoextremist.com, or you can follow him at twitter.com/autoextremist. And you can always get David's work, and he's got a big article out right now on Dan Akerson, the new CEO and chairman of GM, and that's in the latest.
Businessweek.com. It's going to be in the latest issue of the magazine that hits the newsstand tomorrow, and there's a version of it on the Bloomberg site, too, should be.
Bloomberg.com. That's great.
All right.
You can also always follow me on faceplant.com.
Visit our website, autolinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, Get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutoLineDetroit.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.